move to the second case of the morning when everything clears out. Next case will be Square D versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Mr. Linguanti.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the Court, my name is Thomas Linguanti, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Square D, in this case. The treaty giveth, and the IRS taketh away. This case asks whether a deduction for interest that is wholly exempt from tax under the U.S.-France tax treaty, and that is owed by Square D, which is a U.S. corporation, to Schneider, its French parent and affiliates, may be denied by an IRS administrative regulation? The answer to that question is no. For if the matching principle of Section 267A2, Internal Revenue Code, means what it says it means, or if non-discrimination under the U.S.-France Treaty means what it says it means, then the regulation is invalid, and the tax court's decision was wrong, and the case should be dismissed, or reversed, excuse me. Now, when we're speaking, of course, of the regulatory validity compared to the statute, it's a classic Chevron analysis. Parties agree that Chevron is a controlling standard here. And then under Chevron step one, the question is, what is the plain meaning of the provision? Well, to match means two. Unless you have an income item for which you must account, then you have nothing to match against. And under the treaty, there is no income item here. Therefore, under the plain meaning of Section 267A2 and A3, the regulation is invalid. Similarly, if there is any ambiguity in the statute, we turn to Chevron step two. And there the question is why? Why treaty exempt interest? Even the IRS needs to have a reason. Even the king must have a reason as to why it makes a decision like this. And there is still none, no explanation, either in the legislative history, the regulatory history, nor in the briefs, as this issue has been briefed, that explains why treaty exempt interest is treated different from any other treaty-exempt items, royalties, dividends, pensions, any other income items. And that makes it arbitrary. Now, when we're dealing with step one, the plain meaning of the statute, we are looking solely at what the matching principle of paragraph 2, which is section 267A2, means. And the matching principle, as this court has identified, cabin taxi for Chicago, Fishman, is about timing. When do you have an income item, and when do you have an expense deduction? And we're dealing with related parties. When do those match up? That's what the matching principle is about. It's always been about.
Now, you have in your diagram here, I'm just looking at Appendix 16, where you set out the accrued interest and then the paid in the interest when it was paid.
Sure.
Which
yes,
I
sir.
Indicate. And I guess I have a preliminary curiosity. In 93 and 94, you also had, looks like, $43 million accrued in each year. Was that deducted also, or what did you do with that?
It was deducted as accrued.
You did that, too, because
yeah.
Ultimately you paid substantially in a balloon payment, I guess, in September 30 of 96, $153 million.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that wiped out or essentially the debt.
It was a payment of the previously accrued interest,
right.
The catch-up payments.
Which is the IRS position is that's when you should have deducted it.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
So I guess that's obviously this is since you have a split decision in the tax court and the reversal of itself, we obviously have a pretty difficult question for a lot of people. So
we're down 20 to 15 at last count, Your Honor.
Yeah, right.
We're not
in the last quarter yet, are we? Okay, well, go ahead.
Thanks.
Well, could I ask you just one more sort of informational thing?
Certainly.
What are we talking about? What's the amount of money we're talking about in this case?
As His Honor points out, in our 2 years, 91, 92, about $60 million in accrued interest deductions that were disallowed. In the subsequent years, approximately about $150, $160 million in interest deductions that were disallowed. In fact, there are at least one, if not two, tax court cases still pending where all other issues have been resolved, but the parties have stipulated to basically wait for the court to do the right thing and reverse the tax court's decision.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But those years are outstanding, pending resolution of this issue.
So what are we talking about, bottom line?
No, $160 million, well, you know, and the 35% tax rate. Plus, this goes back to 91, 92, so obviously significant interest that would come into play. Okay. Now, when we're talking about, of course, A2, well, the relevance here is Section 267A3, which applies and directs the Secretary to apply the matching principle of Paragraph 2, A2. And that's a clarification. A3 does precisely what it should do, which it directs the Secretary to basically promulgate legislative regulations to apply the matching principle in the context of foreign-related parties. Because when we're dealing with foreign-related issues or foreign issues generally, we're dealing with effectively connected income issues, source income issues, treaty issues, controlled foreign corporations, foreign personal holding companies, that overlay. And by directing the Secretary to issue regulations in that area, well, that's precisely what A3 accomplished. And in fact, but for the couple of places where the regulation went off the beam, if you will, the regulations applied those rules correctly. In every circumstance of in the foreign world of effectively connected income, source income, and treaties, except with regard to treaty exempt interest, the regulations apply the matching principle of Section 267A2 correctly. And that's what A3 directs. And that's precisely what it's supposed to do. Now, if, though, there is some ambiguity, and obviously the Third Circuit felt that there was, although we'd submit that the Third Circuit didn't do the hard work perhaps they should have done on analyzing the plain meaning of matching, what it means to match. But Third Circuit and, of course, Square D, the tax court decision below, found ambiguity in the statutory construct and turned to Chevron Step 2. Now, what Peyton Lyle did not address, in fact, with the Square D tax court decision was raised there but not addressed by the court, is this question: why treaty-exempt interest? Why that decision? Why that determination? All treaty-exempt income that exists except for interest would have gotten this deduction upon accrual, a treaty-exempt royalty, a treaty-exempt dividend, a treaty-exempt anything. But treaty-exempt interest has been carved out. You see in the briefs, we talk about the interest carve-out. Well, that's what we're talking about. And there still today is no justification, rationalization, explanation for why treaty-exempt interest has been carved out from the rule.
Well, how would those other three use dividends or royalties, that sort of thing? That's not specially treated as a deduction anywhere, is it?
They would all be entitled, if Square D had a royalty owed to Schneider, its French parent, all things being equal, it would have been able to take the deduction for that royalty upon accrual. Because it's interest, it has to wait until payment, according to Section 363C2.
I guess I'm looking at it. Isn't interest given some sort of a special status in the IRS? I may be wrong, but isn't that usually the case?
In this area?
Well, the problem is with this area is I don't know about this area.
Fair enough.
But in any area where interest is a deduction as opposed to interest paid, as opposed to other things?
Not so, Your Honor, and perhaps I can. Certainly a deduction for accrual of interest under 163.
Just interest, period.
Understand. That's all passive, and all passive income typically is treated the same throughout the Internal Revenue Code. In fact, the controlled foreign corporation rules, foreign personal holding company rules, and the subpart F provisions in this area are all about passive income, so interest, royalties, dividends. Interest under the matching principle historically has been identified as, like any other expense with related parties, different. Interest itself has in 267, certainly true. But treaty-exempt interest is different, because once you interpose the treaty and the effects that has onto the interest itself, well, then we're not dealing with the historic interest, if you will, the concerns the government had about interest, perhaps historically. You're dealing with now a treaty-exempt item. But interest itself as passive income is treated consistently throughout the Internal Revenue Code, both as an income item and as a deduction. Indeed, the initial regulatory notice, notice 89-94, is the citation to it, when the IRS first told the world it was about to, a number of years later, promulgate regulations in this area, actually treated all treaty-exempt income the same. And it said that the matching principles or the fallback, the cash method, would apply to all treaty-exempt income, royalties, dividends, they'd all be treated the same. But as you point out in the brief, somebody obviously complained about it. There's nothing in the public record to say who or what the concern was, but somebody complained about, well, why royalties, why all these other things. And the IRS then carved out treaty-exempt interest. So treaty-exempt royalties and all the rest are not subject to the matching principles. They're not subject to the cash method. Treaty-exempt interest, though, still is. But there's no explanation in the regulations, regulatory history, legislative history, and the like that says why. And that's arbitrary. That's arbitrary and capricious by definition, because there is no explanation. Now, what that explanation needs to be, there's probably gradations of propriety, but if the IRS had an analysis at the time under the classic arbitrary and capricious standard, then we'd be in a different situation, but they don't and have never. And indeed, the policy, and this goes to the treatment of interest perhaps slightly differently in this area, the policy has always been about the manipulation by related parties of their expenses. In fact, interest tended to be historically that type of thing that you could manipulate. I could take a loan from my related party, my parent corporation, and because I'm on an accrual basis and they're on a cash method basis perhaps, I could manipulate when I took the deduction and they took the income in it. But that does not exist here. It doesn't exist here because there is no income hit. There is no income for which the related parties must account, because it is, as a matter of law, not income. It is not includable in gross income when we're dealing with treaty-exempt interest. And that's the quirk. And, of course, when you're dealing with the treaty overlay, it makes it something different as well. So the policy justification 70 years ago in this area that created this matching principle doesn't exist here either for why treaty-exempt interest. Now, if somehow or another the regulation survives the Chevron two-step, as the writers like to call it, then we're faced with Article 24.3 of the U.S.-France tax treaty. This is the 1967 treaty, which the parties have stipulated to, and everyone agrees, is relevant to these tax years. And what we're dealing with here is what we call the ownership provision, the capital provision. It's not about discrimination of Schneider, the French company. Are they discriminating as the tax provision or the regulation discriminating against Schneider? The question is whether, because Square D being subjected to other or more burdensome tax requirements, that a U.S. corporation was owned by a U.S. corporation would not be. There's no
presumably they would be on the same accounting, both on accrual, though, wouldn't they?
Certainly. Carrying on the same activities is the only requirement. And most companies, in fact, as a matter of Internal Revenue Code, a matter of law, if you have more than $5 million of gross receipts, you are a accrual method taxpayer. So as we illustrate in, I think, our reply brief, if Square D was competing against U.S. Electrical, and U.S. Electrical was owned by a U.S. corporation, whereas Square D is owned by a French corporation, Schneider, U.S. Electrical would get the deduction upon accrual. Square D does not. And it is irrelevant to Article 24.3, this ownership provision of the treaty, what the treatment of Schneider is, or the hypothetical U.S. parent corporation, because that's about direct discrimination against the citizens of another country. The capital ownership provision, Article 24.3, is about the treatment of the, in this case, the U.S. subsidiaries. If so long as they're carrying on the same activities, the only question is, are they being subjected to other or more burdensome tax requirements? That's it. And here they are, by definition. Square D does not get the deduction upon accrual in 1991 and 1992. U.S. Electrical, under our hypothetical, does. And the government would admit that the only distinction here is that that Square D is owned by a French corporation, by Schneider. That's the only distinction. And if that's not discrimination, I'm not entirely sure what is under Article 24.3. Lastly, we'd point out, and say the balance of our time for rebuttal, of course, is that only Congress has the authority here to override a treaty. It's up to Congress to say, despite the fact there is a treaty, you will be subjected to the matching principle or the cash method. And there's nothing, again, not even in the legislative history, if we're in a Chevron Step 2 world, there is nothing where Congress has suggested in Section 267 that they are overriding the treaty provision. In fact, they do. There are other provisions nearby where they do precisely that. 163E3, I believe, is the section.
Is this provision or this situation sufficiently vague or split decision that Congress needs to cure it?
And from in our view, yes. Yes. If it's a problem, if there's a hole in the dike, it's for the congressional thumb.
Not us?
No, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hogg.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mike Hongs from the Department of Justice on behalf of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. The case involves two major issues concerning the validity of this regulation. First, we contend that the regulation at issue was adopted under a specific grant of statutory authority from Congress, and under the standard of Chevron, that regulation represents a permissible construction of the statute. That was the conclusion that the Third Circuit reached almost 10 years ago. In the Tate and Lyle case, the Third Circuit was right, and this court, we submit, should follow the Tate and Lyle decision on that point. The second issue in the case concerns this treaty issue. The regulation here does not violate the non-discrimination provision of the 1967 treaty because it does not distinguish or discriminate between companies based on the ownership of capital. Any corporation, whether it is U.S.-owned or French-owned, has to use the cash method of accounting for payments to a related foreign corporation. And I think I'd like to, because it was the focus of Square D's reply brief, I think I would like to begin with that treaty issue. I would like to clarify a bit what we talked about in our brief. We discussed this point at pages 59 and 60. In retrospect, I wish we'd emphasized it more. But the issue here is that the treaty and the regulation actually use rather different standards for determining foreignness, if you will, versus American-owned or domestic. The treaty is focused on the ownership of capital. The issue in the treaty is a company treated differently because its capital is owned by French people or a French corporation as opposed to one that is owned by American corporations or Americans? The regulation does not focus on ownership of capital at all. It uses the term foreign, but it uses it in a different way. The regulation talks about transfers or payments to foreign persons, and it defines that term foreign persons, related foreign persons, with respect to Section 7701A30 of the code. It says that a foreign person is a person who is not a United States person within the meaning of 7701A30. That's the general definition section of the code.
What's that, where it's incorporated?
Correct. Exactly. The United States person is defined as being, in relevant parts, includes people as well, but for corporations, a domestic corporation. If we look back to the definition of domestic, which is 7701A4, domestic corporation is defined as a corporation that's organized or incorporated under the laws of the United States or any state. So, and then foreign corporation is a corporation that's not a domestic corporation. So putting that all together, what that means is Square D is a domestic corporation here. It was way back when in the 80s, before it was acquired by Schneider. It still is today. It doesn't have anything to do with who owns its capital. It's a Delaware corporation, therefore it's a domestic corporation. Schneider, for purposes of that regulation, is a foreign corporation, not because it's owned by people in France, but because it is incorporated in France. It's not incorporated within the United States. What this means is, if I take this hypothetical of the U.S. Electric that Mr. Linguanti mentioned, the problem with that hypothetical is that it's actually changing two variables. In that hypothetical, it's not just changing the ownership of capital, it's effectively changing the place of incorporation. This hypothetical U.S. Electric that would be the parent corporation of Square D would be an American incorporated corporation, if I understand this hypothetical. I think the relevant hypothetical here is one that the taxpayer mentions on page 11 of the reply brief. Down near the bottom of page 11, they bring up another hypothetical, and with all due respect, they get it a little bit wrong. This hypothetical is, if we imagine that Square D, absolutely a domestic corporation incorporated in Delaware, Schneider, French corporation incorporated in France, if we imagine that both of them were owned by a common parent corporation, what they say is that the tax treatment depends on whether that common parent is American or French. Not true. If the common parent is a French corporation, this regulation applies. The transfer from Schneider, domestic corporation, to the related foreign person gets caught up by this rule and is required to be subjected to the cash method of accounting. But that's true even if the common parent were American. So in other words, there's no discrimination going on in this case based upon the ownership of capital. What the regulation is distinguishing is the place of incorporation, regardless of who the parent corporation is or who the owner corporation is.
Well, the non-discriminatory purpose of the treaty, then, if it focuses on the ownership of capital,
correct.
You're saying that even if we'll call it the holding company or whatever the parent company is, if you have a French corporation and a U.S. corporation as incorporated, then this reg would still apply.
Right. If the parent corporation, regardless of whether it's an American company or a French company,
and you'd base it just on I guess the domicile of that corporation. I'd say where it's incorporated.
Correct,
I don't want to use terms that are confusing.
It gets very confusing, yes.
Okay, where it's incorporated.
Correct.
And clearly then, in this case, Square D is incorporated, and was and continues to be incorporated in the United States.
Correct. It is and always has been a domestic corporation.
And Schneider, and I'm not quite sure what this acquisition subsidiary is. What is that? Is that incorporated?
I don't recall. I'm not sure that it matters anymore because it went out of existence. I think the issue was they created a new corporation which did the work of acquiring Square D, and then it merged into Square D, or it
along
merged
with
into
its,
Schneider.
Along with its debt.
Correct. It
took
went
its,
away.
It took its debt, merged with Square D, and then it, I guess, dissolved or something.
I think
so
that's
whatever
correct,
it was,
yes.
You say it doesn't matter.
That's our view, yes. Mr. Linguanti, he may know the facts of the underlying transaction better, but I
don't
believe
want to know any more
that
facts if I don't have to.
Fortunately, this case does not seem to turn too much in the facts. Most
I'm
of
intrigued
are
by the ownership of capital. How do we determine who, how does that fit in? The ownership of capital could be any place in the world.
It does, and to be honest, I don't know exactly how that would work in all circumstances, other than it is stipulated here that Schneider is a French corporation and that the ownership of capital of Schneider is in France. There's no dispute in this case.
Is it publicly traded?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether it's publicly traded on a French stock exchange or whether it's owned by a group of individuals in France. I don't know. I don't think it matters for purposes of this case. I think it's clear that it is a French-owned corporation. But the point here, the bottom line, is there's no discrimination under the treaty. And the tax court said this in its decision. It's taken me a while to really understand what exactly the tax court meant. It's because that regulation doesn't discriminate based on ownership of capital. It treats companies the same, whether they're owned by French people or French corporations, or whether they're owned by Americans. And that's why we submit that the tax court was absolutely correct in deciding that there is no discrimination in violation of the treaty here.
Correct the second time.
Correct in the decision that's before you today, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. In the earlier case, actually in Tate and Lyle, that argument was not raised.
Oh.
The argument was not made in the Tate and Lyle case. So the Third Circuit did not address that at all.
Of course, if we go against the Third Circuit, we need all the judges on this court to approve it.
I'm not sure what your internal rules are.
Well, split into circuits.
I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't.
Unless there are there any others?
Is there an existing split?
No, there's not an existing split.
Well,
the Third Circuit's the only one that has gone this way.
All our judges to agree?
Yes.
It's a little nugget of information you might be interested in.
The thought has crossed our mind that this court might be reluctant to disagree with one of its sister circuits. And indeed, we cited the Bell Federal case, indicating that obviously a court is always reluctant to disagree with a circuit, but that this court has said, particularly in the tax area, it's important to be in harmony with its other courts, with the other courts of appeals, and should not go against them unless they are shown to be clearly wrong. And we submit that Square D has not made a showing that it was clearly wrong.
Well, I assume the tax court reversed itself in view of the Third Circuit.
That's correct, and that's why the tax court decision that is before you today is effectively an en banc decision. They call it a reviewed decision, but it was reviewed by all of the 15, 16, 17 active judges of the tax court, and by a majority of, I think, 10 to 5 or 10 to 6, they ruled in favor of the government, and they explicitly overruled their earlier decision in Tate and Lyle.
Was that a lesser judge? How many... The earlier decision was how many of the members of the tax court?
It was also a reviewed decision. I don't remember how many voted in which direction.
So it's still the full court.
Correct.
You know,
the earlier Tate and Lyle decision was a full
court.
It was reversed by the Third Circuit. And of course, the way the tax court works, I believe they could have continued to rely on the Tate and Lyle precedent for cases that were not appealable to the Third Circuit. They followed the rule of the circuit to which a particular case is appealable. But they have decided to overrule that as do all circuits, effectively, in their reviewed decision in this case. So, yes, I think Tate and Lyle, particularly when we get now to the other part of the case, which is the Chevron argument, Tate and Lyle considered that in detail. Square D has not shown it to have been erroneous, and we submit that this court should simply follow what Tate and Lyle did. The one, I think, new argument that they are making is an argument that they actually barely even raised in the tax court. It was mentioned in passing in one of their briefs in the tax court. In this case, they're emphasizing it on appeal, and it's this idea that the regulation draws a distinction between interest and other kinds of expenses or other kinds of payment that Square D might be making to its parent, Schneider. As we pointed out in our brief, there is actually some historical pedigree for that in the sense that going all the way back to 1937, when Congress first addressed this problem of matching, it focused on interest. The statute referred to interest and other expenses, and the legislative history, as we quoted it in the brief, 1937 report, I believe, of the House, indicated that Congress thought interest was a particular problem. And the Secretary continues to think interest is a particular problem. It would seem to be, of all of the kinds of expenses, the one that is most subject to manipulation or subject to abuse. And I guess it's worth pointing out that effectively this statute as a whole, all of 267A, is really kind of an anti-abuse provision. It's meant to prevent the situation where there are related taxpayers, meaning related corporations like in this case, or even if we're talking about individual taxpayers who are members of the same family, where there's a sense that they are not dealing at arm's length with each other. When one of them is accruing an expense that it owes to a related corporation, it might not have to make that payment immediately, as I would to my mortgage company. My mortgage company is not going to let me accrue interest for several years and then pay it all in a lump sum later on. But when the corporations are related to one another, Congress was very concerned going all the way back to 37 that the corporation might never pay the interest or might pay it in a year when the recipient, its brother, sister corporation, would have offsetting losses so that it would be the most tax-advantaged way of doing it.
Would they make then a distinction in, say, royalties and dividends? They would, you wouldn't sit on those, I guess. Is that the difference? Whereas in interest, you don't, maybe a forgiveness of a debt internally or something, whereas with, is there a distinction with royalties and dividends and whatever the third thing they mentioned?
Yeah, I think that the interest is the one that is the most forgivable, so to speak, whereas other kinds of payments might be harder to forget about or forgive. And just in general, the point we made in our brief was really when the Secretary decides to adopt a legislative regulation in an area like this, he does not have to make it comprehensive. He does not have to focus on every possible problem of abuse. A legislature or a Treasury Secretary adopting regulations can logically begin with what seems to the policymaker, the decision maker, the most acute aspect of the problem, or just the best part of it to bite off initially. We certainly would say, given the legislative history here, particularly where Congress specifically envisioned that the Secretary could, Congress did say could or might rather than had to, but Congress envisioned that the Secretary could adopt a regulation that would require the cash basis method of accounting for things like, for other expenses like royalty payments. The Treasury Secretary decided not to do that but to focus on interest. We'd certainly say the Secretary has that discretion and at some point in the future could decide if that were appropriate to expand that focus.
Would the reason be because interest is such a much larger number, whereas royalties, dividends, and I think you mentioned a third thing, I don't know what it was, but that it's not, I don't want to say it's not material, but it isn't very significant by comparison.
That's my sense, yes. That's my sense. I have to admit it is not stated that way anywhere in the Federal Register notice that promulgates the final regulation. The Secretary did not lay out an explanation of why he was distinguishing between interest and other kinds of payments, but as we pointed out in our brief, he's not required to explain every provision. He didn't explain a lot of other things in that statute or in that regulation, but there's no indication in the regulatory statement, the statement of basis and purpose, there's no indication that there was a comment on this point that the Secretary was ignoring. In fact, the issue was not raised in the earlier Tate and Lyle case, which I would point out was handled by the same law firm. They
Notice
apparently
that.
Didn't think of that point.
You both were there, right?
I personally was not, but my supervisor was, yes. Oh. This is a bit of a rematch, you might say.
Okay.
But on that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the court has. Otherwise, I would just rest on our briefs. Thank you very much.
Mr. Linguanti.
Thank you, Your Honors. Perhaps if we can stick with the treaty for a moment and correct the correction of my hypothetical. Let's be clear. If there was a U.S. parent and a foreign subsidiary in Square D, and Square D had an interest owed to that foreign subsidiary owned by the U.S. parent, Square D would be entitled to that deduction upon accrual. Not upon payment, upon accrual, which it is not entitled to here. Why? Because in that case, for the same reasons counsel identified about the ownership provisions and the definition of corporations under the rules, then the subpart F provisions would come into place, which would require that amount owed to a foreign subsidiary would be taken into account by the U.S. corporation, a hypothetical U.S. parent, at the time of accrual. That's the provision. That's how it works. That's the distinction. And that's why it's only because Schneider is French that it gets unable, or Square D is unable to deduct the interest upon accrual.
Mr. Ngata, you knew that we had to get all the judges on this court.
I was looking forward to it, Your Honor. Sure. It's the issue, though, for us, of course, is that obviously we think Tate and Lyle's plain meaning analysis is wrong, with all due respect to actually Judge Mansman, who's an excellent judge. But they didn't do the work. But the arbitrary analysis was never brought up, perhaps, although I point out that we were representative of the amicus parties at the time, not the direct parties at the time. And actually, I was on the other side of the table at that time as well. But the arbitrary and capricious analysis was never done the way we've identified it here. It's not a question of reasonableness. The question is, have they made an arbitrary distinction? And certainly the case that the non-discrimination provision of the U.S.-UK treaty at the time, which was the relevant treaty in Tate and Lyle, was never at issue there either. So in a way, we can agree with Tate and Lyle that the statute is ambiguous under Chevron Step 1, but then reach a different conclusion either under Chevron Step 2 or even agree with Tate and Lyle entirely but overlay the treaty and the non-discrimination that exists here, that is violated here by the regulation. You know, it is the case that, representing a French company, that there's why you have the civil law versus common law distinction. And just because Tate and Lyle got it wrong doesn't mean we have to as well. you know, this, when we talk about some factual things quickly, the acquisition subsidiary did go away upon the merger. Schneider is a publicly traded corporation in France. Distinction, counsel in argument, as the government did in its briefs, and as Tate and Lyle did in its opinion, raised the wrong question. It is not, and we are not arguing, whether the treatment of interest different from anything else is appropriate. We are arguing specifically the treatment of treaty-exempt interest. And the third thing we always mention is royalties, dividends, and pensions, passive types of income. Just
with,
for
is that distinction, though, that he makes with between the I'm not clear exactly what it is, but where the treaty is focuses on the ownership of capital as opposed to the place of incorporation.
Well, in a way,
meaning I mean, when you talk about foreign, I guess.
Counsel's arguing is that. Unless you say expressly, I hereby discriminate against a company that is owned by a French company, I do not discriminate. That's what it boils down to. It is absolutely the case that the treaty provides simply, there is no because of test. It isn't, are you being discriminated against because you are French, right, or owned by a French corporation? Place of incorporation, art equilibrium. There's no real distinction when you're talking about the ownership provisions in the code versus the ownership provisions under the treaty for the purposes of this analysis. The sole question is, are you being subjected, are you as a U.S. corporation whose capital is owned by another being subjected to other or more burdensome requirements? That's it. So long as you're carrying on the same activities, perhaps it's a distinction between a finance company maybe and a manufacturing company. That's a little ambiguous.
Because we don't know who owns the capital in a publicly traded corporation.
No. We know the place of incorporation is France. And that's all that's required, and here the parties have stipulated to that ownership. Schneider is a French corporation. Schneider is subject to and gets the benefit of the treaty, et cetera, as well. Distinction without a difference, I guess, is the cliche, but the distinction for the treaty's purposes is irrelevant. The question is simply whether Square D is being subjected to other more burdensome tax requirements as a company that is otherwise owned by a U.S. corporation. Good with that, Your Honors. Unless the court has any further questions, appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.